What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson.
I've spent the best years of my life on you. A woman wants to be something else besides a mother, you know. Well, you will know when you get grown up. You can't explain everything to a child. Now go on, run along.
That's current Film Spotting Marathon subject Barbara Stanwyck in a heartbreaking, if you've seen it, moment from the 1937 melodrama Stella Dallas.
Our Summer of Stanwyck continues this week with a review of Stella Dallas, plus our top five movie mother-daughters.
That and more.
Have I spent the best years of my life on Film Spotting?
It's all ahead on Film Spotting. Welcome to Film Spotting. Back in March 2013, Josh, we did our top five movie mother-daughters. That is, movies about mothers and daughters. Though we could have done this. Debbie Reynolds, Carrie Fisher. Get it? Movie mothers and daughters?
Yeah, but that would be the nepotism episode, right? And that is not, that's frowned upon these days, Adam. So I don't think we should do that.
I think I probably could have given you 100 guesses, and you would not have been able to place the movie that we connected that top five to.
I'm sure, though Sam dropped a few clues here in our notes, and even with those, it took me a little bit. But yeah, go ahead, throw those clues out there. Let's see if the listeners can ID it.
Okay, it was an English language directing debut. There are no prizes here, by the way. Nicole Kidman, Matthew Good, Mia Wasikowska.
Yeah, I think it took Wasikowska for me to remember, oh yeah, that was Stoker from Park Chan-wook, which I think we both liked quite a bit.
Mixed.
You were a little cooler on it than me. Okay.
Yeah, I think so. Later in the show, we'll revisit our top five movie mother-daughters, and we'll see if we can come up with any titles that have come out since 2013 that could compete for a spot on our list. Like, I don't know, everything Greta Gerwig has directed since then.
First, though, let's get to the second film in our Summer of Stanwyck marathon, 1937's Stella Dallas. This marathon is devoted to golden age of Hollywood great Barbara Stanwyck, specifically her career from the early 30s through the mid 40s. That's a period that saw her receive three of her four Best Actress Oscar nominations. Last week, we kicked off the marathon with the provocative 1933 Precoz drama Babyface. That had Stanwyck playing a young woman who exploits her beauty to acquire wealth and status. Hearts are broken, lives are destroyed, men die. Stella Dallas, kind of a different film, you could say.
It is very different, though there are some broken hearts and lives are kind of destroyed. And also not so different from Babyface. The Stanwyck we meet at the beginning of Stella Dallas is, like Babyface's Lily Powers, stuck in circumstances she longs to escape. But instead of a seamy Pittsburgh speakeasy and an abusive dad, Stella is stuck in a working class mill town with dreamy aspirations of a more glamorous life. And she has an eye on John Bowles' Stephen Dallas, a down on his luck mill executive. Using some powers of seduction that Lily Powers might appreciate, Stella actually gets the attention of Dallas, and they are quickly married. A baby soon follows. I think it's all of one cut. We go from marriage to baby, and that's where things start to get complicated.
Isn't that how it works? You're telling me that some more birds and bees are involved there, Adam? Stella soon begins to chafe at her husband's formality and the rigid expectations of her new class status. Soon, her husband is spending most of his time working out of town and falling back in love with his ex-fiance, Helen, played by Barbara O'Neill. That leaves Stella alone to raise their daughter, Laurel, who is played as a teen by Anne Shirley. Stella's devoted to Laurel, but she eventually realizes she can't give her daughter the life that she thinks she deserves.
Stella Dallas is a melodrama, so spoilers, things don't turn out too great for Stanwyck Stella. The movie, directed by King Vidor and adapted from a 1925 novel, was nominated for two Oscars, one for Stanwyck, her first Best Actress nomination, and one for Shirley. Josh, this is a film I had seen before. In fact, I probably watched it in preparation for the top five we're going to revisit later. It's new to you. Tell me, after seeing it, that there's a sadder movie and a sadder final shot in cinema history. And tell me how right I was to include it among my top five movie mothers and daughters.
Yeah, you sort of have to. And it's interesting, you know, we'll get to this, but immediately I started thinking of the Joan Crawford film, Mildred Pierce, which has a similar mother-daughter dynamic and made my list. And that's been kind of a recurring thing. I wonder how it'll continue with this marathon. Crawford and Stanwyck, their careers working in parallel with similar parts and stories. So yeah, good pick for the list. Absolutely. Extremely sad, though this movie lays it on awfully thickly by its conclusion in making sure we understand just how morose and abandoned and alone, how literally on the outside looking in Stella Dallas is, how she's been in many ways brought entirely back to where she was at the beginning. She's maybe a bit more comfortable. She has some sort of financial compensation from Stephen after all this. Yet she is watching her daughter from afar, somewhat happy that she's attained this life, but still alone, not able to be a part of it. And I think that's the true tragedy here, is not so much that Stella doesn't get what she wants or that she's separated from her daughter, but that this is a woman who defines her life by class. And let me alter how I phrase that, because I think what's interesting about Stella Dallas is that it's not a film that demands we make judgments about the character in the way other melodramas might. It's more about a society that places class, so much importance on class, that a woman like Stella Dallas has no choice but to play that game. And when she loses that game, she's completely lost. I think that's sort of the judgment, quote unquote, that is going on here, is that this is a broken, corrupt society that Stella Dallas tries to, you know, move up the ladder in and ultimately can't manage to do that. She makes some bad decisions, but it's not really by any failing on her part. It's really because the cards are stacked against her, against someone like her from rising too far. You know, it's got to be that next generation who gets a little polished, who, you know, doesn't speak in a way that makes people look twice or is willing to be more careful about her language. That's the person who can maybe rise a little higher. There's a ceiling. There's a ceiling for Stella Dallas, and the tragedy is watching her bump up against it and not be able to break through.
Yeah, and the biggest deterrence in terms of that ceiling or that limitation is the family. It is the daughter. Babyface, of course, the pre-code Hollywood film, we don't have that dynamic at play. So you can have someone like her, Lily, be much more ambitious, and she is, in that case, more capable of altering herself and putting on the performance that she has to in order to move up that ladder, as she very much does in that film. So very different films, obviously, Babyface to this one, but we do see Stanwyck, as we alluded to earlier, in a very similar position. And you mentioned that maybe she doesn't quite get what she wants. I'd argue, and this is purely semantics at this point, because I know we're talking around the same thing, but she does get what she wants at the end of that film. And what I think Hollywood wants her to want, which is she has completely sacrificed for her daughter, and her daughter is happy. And her daughter will never have to make the same sacrifices that she does. So in that case, even though it's bittersweet, obviously, it is what I think we have to believe Stella cares about more than anything in the world, and that's what she gets. And I do love that final moment, not only the sadness of it, that bittersweetness of it, but the fact that we do see her walk away with that empowered smile on her face. It's something that I think Stanwyck, or maybe even, you know, a lesser performer, might have gone for some pity there in that moment. But Stanwyck transitions right from pity into something that does feel a little bit more empowered. You know what else I love about that moment? I mentioned it being maybe the saddest shot in the history of cinema. It does make me think about the mechanism of cinema itself. And I don't think by accident. When I taught a movies about movies class at the Graham School at the University of Chicago, we used as a text the book Hollywood Reflected, Movies About Movies. And the author of that book makes an argument that all Hollywood films are really about Hollywood, and that they all in some way or another reinforce myths about Hollywood that then reinforce the idea of audiences coming out and engaging with those myths and keeping the machinery turning. And Stella Dallas isn't in the index of that book, but maybe it should be, because that final shot, you notice how Helen, the new mother, the stepmother, asks the help to open the curtains, just like the movie curtain, this great horizontal wide window. And then we see that shot from the outside. And you think about this movie being made or coming out in 1937 during the Great Depression, and the impoverished are out there looking through the windows at the rich people having their big soiree. And it probably mirrors the exact same experience a lot of mothers like Barbara Stanwyck, Stella, had back in 1937, going to the cinema and watching from the dark and looking up at that screen and taking in all the rich people having this grand time that they only get to experience vicariously. And that's what's happening with Stella at the end.
Oh, there's absolutely an aspirational element to it, but it sounds like you're reading it as a little more triumphant, which is interesting that you say it's also one of the saddest shots.
Yeah.
Because I'd love to go back and watch that that sequence again and just observe, you know, how she does play that on her face. Because I agree that element is there. Like, this is the end game for Stella Dallas, right? To get Laurel in this position, to get this guy to be in that mansion and have all of that around, to be accepted. This is her, less than her daughter's marriage, it's her daughter's acceptance in her mind. So you're right, like that, this is her goal being achieved. And I think we recognize that she's acknowledging that, but I feel like I still detect a little bit of critique in this film about the true value of that. And that's where, you know, it's in the rain and the tear, like Stella is still with the bums. I don't know if the police officers that push them away from the window actually say that, but they say something to the effect is like, move along. And you get the sense that, as you describe, this is the lower class here.
Yeah,
and okay, you've seen enough, right? At some point they say, you've seen enough. This is all you get, to your point about it being the movie. Get out now of the theater. The fantasy.
Show's over.
The fantasy is over. And I do think there's some critique here in the film that there is a falseness, to me at least. There's also recognition that this may be Stella's goal that, yes, she has achieved, but there's a falseness to that being her goal in the first place. There's a loss here. I don't know that she's really going to have much of a relationship anymore with Laurel, which we've come to see is crucial to her. This is almost like she's pushing her on to a different life she can only have if Stella is not a part of it. So I read it maybe as a little bit more tragic with and a little bit more critique to it, I would say.
Well, I see it as undeniably tragic. I don't know how much of the element of critique I really buy, and that I think ultimately the movie perhaps reinforces some conventional wisdom, and it wants her as a mother to only be committed to her child and really want nothing more. And that in the movie's eyes, it might actually be okay that all she wants for her daughter is to assimilate. So I maybe see that a little bit differently, but I do want to clarify that I think the ending, one of the things that's so great about it is that it plays both of those moments. It's a long enough and drawn out enough moment that moment itself, looking through the window, destroys me. It destroys me. And just the thought of it destroys me. And here's the thing I'd forgotten about this film, because I hadn't seen it in a long time. There are four other moments leading up to that one that crush me as well. Like, if I asked you to pick your saddest moment, I don't know that it would even be the end for everybody, though it probably would be. But then it's when she does finally turn and walk away, and she gets the kiss, just like in the movies, right? You get the payoff of the kiss, and then she turns and walks away, and you see that smile that isn't just a reluctant smile. It actually has some zest to it. It isn't her just kind of slinking off into the night. And the way Stanwyck plays Stella throughout really is a wonder that she didn't win a Best Actress award for this. I don't know what her competition was. I'd have to go back and look. She did get the nomination, but I watched this performance actually just kind of in awe the whole time at the fact that despite it being this melodrama, despite it being a film that clearly wants to pull at you and get you to weep a little bit, she never overplays a single moment. And in fact, any moment of real revelation or where her character either discovers something or has to make a difficult choice, she always does the most subtle thing she possibly could. It's like Stanwyck knows the power of her face on that screen, and that if she trusts the writing and she trusts the audience will figure out what Stella's feeling in that moment, and she doesn't have to play it for us.
I was trying to figure out a way. I was just entranced with what she was doing with her voice in this movie and trying to figure out a way to describe it. And where I eventually landed was that it's almost like a lasso that she is just whipping around this film. When you think of her at the start, when she's still living with her brother and parents in this dingy factory town, and her voice is very sharp. It's very stinging. She argues with her brother. That's how we're introduced to her.
Stella's got a fella, only he don't know it.
Who?
You, that's who. My own sister, standing out here every night making a sap out of herself over a guy who don't even know she's on earth.
You mind your own business. Anyway, she don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, I don't, huh?
And then, not too many scenes later, when she encounters John Bull Stephen, the executive at the factory, sees him as a likely target, or maybe I shouldn't be so unkind, sees him as a likely romantic interest, suddenly that lasso becomes soft and coiled, and it kind of lures him in. And she tells him she wishes he could teach her how to carry herself with class.
I want to be like all the people you've been around, educated, you know, and speak English.
Don't be like anyone else. I like you the way you are.
No, I don't want to be like me. Not like the people in this place, but like the people in the movie. You know, doing everything well-bred and refined.
And dull. Stay as you are. Don't pretend, Stella.
And there's a genuine yearning there. You know, she's being legit, I feel like. But then, once she's roped him into marriage, this is one of the most interesting transitions. You would see this trajectory. We do see it in Babyface, where Lily just keeps getting more and more sophisticated. Her makeup, her hair, her clothing, we talked about, right? She just continues to ascend. Yes. Stella does something different. And you see it in her voice as well. Yes. After the marriage, and she's gotten what she wants, now comfortable, she goes back to that coarser snap of the lasso, that harsh use of her voice.
Stephen.
Yes, dear?
A dance at the River Club tomorrow night. I think I can wear my blue dress. I'll let it out a little at the top.
But Stella, you don't want to go dancing already.
Before I went to the hospital, I was stuck in this house for 4 solid months without going anywheres. And we just got into the River Club. All my life, I've just about died to go to the real places and get in with the right crowd. And just when I get a chance and get started, I have to give it all up.
We'll go next time.
Well, I don't want to go next time. I want to go this time.
There's even a little bit of self-satisfaction in it. It's almost like now that she's comfortable, now that she has what she wants, she doesn't want to pretend anymore. She wants to be who she is. She wears her lower class origins. In some sense, these are in the early scenes, because I think it does change later, but like a badge, you know? And there are even points where she rubs it into her husband's face, associating with the racehorse breeder played by Alan Hale and the like. She doesn't want to entirely turn into a new person. You know, there's something about this is who I am. And now that I've achieved what I've achieved, I don't want to pretend anymore, which I think is an interesting distinction from her Lily Powers in Babyface.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, I think that, of course, has a lot to do, again, with the pre-code film versus now this more conventional for the time melodrama, and you see a completely different type of character. I give Stella maybe a little bit more credit than you. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I don't see her, even though she puts on a little bit of a show without a doubt to get Stephen, I don't see her as targeting him at all in the way that Lily Powers targets someone, for example, and then keeps up the charade as long as she can keep getting everything she wants. I believe that she, and she says this at one point, I take her at face value, I believe she really does love Stephen. I think it's interesting, though I can't quite understand what the point of it is, though now I'm going to tie it back to the point I was making about the meta aspect of this film. She's laying on her bed like a teen girl, looking at the story, this bizarre suicide story, and the falling out between these people and this man, Stephen, who looks like a matinee idol. It's like she's a teeny bopper who, before there were teeny boppers, back in the 30s, who's looking at the playbill and seeing Clark Gable or something, and she's pining after him. And I believe she really does love him. But yes, once she gets him, and once she thinks she has it, she has everything she needs, she has happiness, to find that he is then going to constantly try to change her and make her something she is not comfortable being, she actually resists. And I think this is where the movie can start to be read with a little bit of a feminist angle.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think where we are on the same page is that this is a more sophisticated version of a woman's picture that wants you to root strictly for or against the central character, or at the very least judge them in some way. I think Stella Dallas is incredibly more sophisticated than that. It's a fascinating character portrait, really, I think, of a woman striving to improve her place in the world, maybe making some poor choices along the way. And the film is also clear that Stephen is making some poor choices along the way as well. So I think it spreads the quote unquote blame around, but I don't know if this is a movie that is interested in blame.
Right.
Or it's more interested in just following the stories of these people. Now, I will say, talking about some of those decisions, Stella definitely has a plan. I mean, I'm not going to sell her short, and she definitely, there's that whole sequence walking back where she just tells Stephen, you know, I wish you could teach me how to talk like you do and be like you are. And then as far as the movie presents it, once the vows are said, those wishes go out the window.
Yeah, but
you know,
I
there are elements of the lifestyle.
I think she believes it in the moment. You're saying you don't.
She's saying that is the way, not Lily Powers. I think, you know, Lily Powers is way more vindictive, right. I think. But I think she's saying what she thinks she needs to say for him to accept a woman in her position.
Yeah.
And I don't think
get me
that
wrong.
Means,
the whole thing with the sandwiches and obviously it's a ruse, but I guess I'm at least allowing that a ruse is a very far cry from the types of charades that Lily Powell plays.
And let's get to the Stephen part of this. I think she's genuinely heartbroken when he says he wants to move for business reasons to New York, and she doesn't want to leave him. I think there is some genuine affection in this relationship, which again is distinct from Lily Powers. At the same time, why does she want to stay? That's an interesting question. On a first viewing, it seems like one of the reasons might be because she likes where she's risen in this town, and it's not going to mean as much if she goes to a new town. Does that make sense? Like, she is now, when she goes to these dances, people know her as, oh, that's Stella? She's now married to Stephen Dallas? Look at her clothes. If she were to go to New York with him, no one knows who she is. And maybe there's a fear there that her lower class distinctions might be exposed. Whereas now, they aren't held against her. They're sort of credit to her. So I think there's a little bit of that going on. But again, I want to reiterate, like, I'm not holding this against the character or the movie. I think what I liked about Stella Dallas is that it's allowing us just to observe these decisions. And I do think as we get into the final third of the film, it shows us a Stella who has been softened by some of these decisions, has made new choices, trying to make up for them. And then the tragedy for me comes in that her decision is to channel all her energy into her daughter's social climbing in order to, you know, make up, quote unquote, make up for her mistakes. And I think that's where she gets caught in this trap, in that it's still the same game she's playing. And if she's going to, quote unquote, win, it's only by sacrificing herself for her daughter.
Yeah, it's a rigged game, but I guess in the world of this film, I don't know what choice she really has. And
she doesn't.
I do think the moment that you're talking about, or that idea where she's sort of wanting to embrace being somebody and staying in New York, while we definitely see that at first, what does she immediately do? I mean, I think the real answer is that she's perfectly content to have him go, because what she really wants is just her daughter. She's okay just being there alone with her daughter and doesn't feel like she really needs him and actually would be happier without him. I mean, I think we get the sense that after he leaves, she barely leaves the house. I think she even expresses that at one point. She pretty much just takes care of her daughter. So she never really does fully embrace that. And I'd also say, you mentioned that you detected some real sadness in her or some feelings for him still. One of the saddest moments in the film, actually, for me, is that exchange that happens, you know, maybe three quarters of the way through, where he comes to get Laurel
for Christmas.
For Christmas.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she has now gotten herself prepared for him in a way that is more subtle, that is more elegant and classy. She has tried to play to him, but there's a softness to it. It's not like she has any agenda at that point.
No, she's being genuine.
She's being genuine. Yep. She really still has feelings for him, and she loves that they are both home for Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And when, even after all that, he rejects her, that close-up of her taking in that he's going to leave with their daughter and that he, of course, has not only not been swayed by any of this to spend any more time with them, he actually is leaving in a little bit of disgust because of the situation with Mun. That is another real tragic moment. And that speaks to the outfits as well. You mentioned it. You're dead on. I love that you brought up her voice, because early on, it actually is hard to listen to. This is whiny Barbara Stanwyck in a way that I don't remember from the other films of hers that I've seen. And not only does that modulate and shift depending on her character and her circumstances, those outfits again. Here I am the second week in a row. You're so right, Josh, where we saw them on this trajectory of elegance last week. Now it's not so much that they just get more and more dowdy or more and more cheap. They are constantly shifting. At first, she's wearing just very simple clothing with no sophistication to them whatsoever. Then as she gets married and we see her in this different cycle of her life, now they just don't seem to actually fit quite right. They're overly puffy and they don't fit her. They drape over her. She is not right for this scenario, and you see it in the way she dresses. And then later, she tries to embrace what she thinks she should be doing, and it becomes this faux sophistication that doesn't work. And finally, it actually becomes garish. It becomes grotesque.
Yeah. Yeah, clownish. And I got to say, I feel like this is maybe one of the weaknesses in the film. I like how you said earlier, and I would agree, that Stanwyck never overplays a moment. These costumes start to overplay the moment. And why it doesn't completely fit for me is because one of the more endearing qualities about her is, even after she has become wealthier and could afford dresses for Laurel from whatever store you get the impression they can go to, she continues to sew them for her. And we get the impression design them. And so early on, you get a sense that this is a woman who has an idea of style. You know, she may not have the means when she was younger, but she has a sense of style. And we see that, as you're saying, in that second phase where she has more money and she's able to choose some nicer clothing items. But then we get to this sequence where she and Laurel go to some fancy resort club.
The Hotel Mirador.
Yes, the Hotel Mirador, right? All the best people are there. These are the people she wants Laurel to get in with. The boy Laurel is either interested in or dating at that point. His family is there.
And Dick Grosvenor.
Yes. Stella, interestingly, hides in the room. So she's self-aware enough. This is where I think like things get a little lost in terms of who this character is. Not on Stanwyck's part at all. But then Stella does make the choice to go down for dinner at some point. And yes, what she's wearing is absolutely clownish. And I just think it makes the point a little bit too loudly. That's the whole idea, loudly, yeah. But it didn't have to be that loud. Let me give an example. There is something she wears at the midpoint of the film, and I don't recall exactly which scene, but it is this, it's not exactly a jacket, but it's a little fuller than a shirt, a long sleeve shirt, but it's made of fur. And it has these various stripes on it. And it's perfect for Stella Dallas because it's a little tacky, but it's also pretty awesome. And that is the sort of thing that captures who this character is to me, is it's not exactly the right thing, but it's kind of the right thing for her. And what they put her in, and I know mm-hmm. this is the point, once she goes to that hotel, is again making her to be a clown. And I just don't think the Stella Dallas we've come to know would, that's just a bridge too far. I think they still could have made the point that she's sticking out like a sore thumb without putting her in those outfits. Because she's almost unrecognizable, honestly, in those sequences.
No, I get that. And I think I probably wouldn't argue with you that maybe they turn the volume up there just a little bit too much. But I also could make the case that it's not so much a character inconsistency as keeping with her resolute sense of individuality, that she just can't really help herself. That to her is something more sophisticated. And you would say, well, but she can make these amazingly sophisticated, classy things for her daughter. But yeah, that's the point. They're for her daughter. I think it's almost as if she can see that and she can make that and recognize that it's something amazing for Laurel, but it would never occur to her to put something like that on. That's just not who she is.
Yeah, I just think she should have worn the fur shirt and we would have been fine.
Can't really argue with that, Josh. Next up in our Summer of Stanwyck Marathon, 1941's The Lady Eve, directed by Preston Sturges. I feel like I've said this before on the show, which would then negate the very thing I'm about to say, but this might be the first two-time marathon film in the history of film spotting.
Okay.
The Lady Eve, part of a very early pre-Josh screwball comedy marathon.
Makes sense.
If I remember correctly, I didn't quite swoon for it the way that my then co-host, now producer, Sam Van Halgren did. So I cannot wait to see this one again and see it in the context of this Stanwyck marathon. You can get The Lady Eve via rental on most platforms. You might also find it at your local library or through interlibrary loan. And if you'd like to check out the full Stanwyck marathon lineup and where to watch those films, go to filmspotting.net/marathons.
So we know Adam has Stella Dallas on his 2013 list of our top five movie mother daughters. How high? We'll discuss that when we come back. Stay with us.
About what's life like?
It's pretty much common knowledge that it takes at least 20 shells to have a community. My cousin fell asleep in a pocket, and that's why I don't like the saying everything comes out of the wash, because sometimes it doesn't, or sometimes it does, and they're just like a completely different person. So it's actually only...
That voice will be familiar to a select few, and maybe not so much to everyone else. Jenny Slate as Marcel the Shell from the trailer for the new stop-motion animated film Marcel the Shell with Shoes On. The film, based on a series of shorts Slate made with her husband, animator Dean Fleischer Camp, is currently playing in very limited release. It will expand into more theaters later this month. Marcel is indeed a shell, a very small shell, with shoes and one googly eye. And in the movie, Marcel goes in search of his family with the help of a documentary filmmaker played by Fleischer Camp. Also helping out, if the trailer is to be believed, Leslie Stahl from 60 Minutes. Josh, Marcel the Shell debuted last fall at Telluride, and it seems like everybody I follow on Letterboxd who has seen it since then has completely swooned for it. Are you among the swooning?
Oh, I'm over swooning for this. I'm swooning for this in a way that people in 5 years will say, why in the world was this on your top 10 list? This is not a top 10 worthy film. I don't know if it'll actually make it to the end of the year, but right now, I think I just needed this movie, Adam. I kind of knew I needed it before I even saw it based on what people had been saying about it, and it did live up to that. If you are struggling down, depressed about the state of the world in any way, for any of the myriad reasons that you might be right now, go see Marcel Duchamp with Shoes On. It's not going to solve your problems, but I'm telling you, even though you might say, I can watch the shorts on YouTube, does it really deserve a big screen? Get to a theater that will have a fairly full group of other people around you, and you're going to laugh at this. And there's a gentleness to this movie, the way it's made and held and presented, that is just so rare nowadays in life and in a lot of our art, quite frankly, which is not a bad thing. Art needs to wrestle with dark things and ask hard questions and show us hard things. But sometimes maybe we go overboard on that because something like this is not quite as edgy, right? But sometimes we need something that's not quite as edgy. And this is incredibly funny. It's fresh, even if you've seen those shorts. It offers just enough of a tweak to the situation with Marcel. And I have to say, you know, I'm a fan of vocal performances when it comes to animated features. And what Jenny Slate does here with Marcel, if you've seen the shorts, you know this, but to watch it at feature length is so incredible. The way she gives him this sense of wonder that is never mawkish, layers in a little bit of wit when Marcel teases Dean about his own life or his own choices, is just so great. Knows how to hit a punchline at just the right moment. She's a comedian first, I think, so that makes sense. And then there are moments in this film where he just offers an observation. I'm not going to spoil it, but the way this movie ends, it's not plot related, so I could describe it, but I don't want to here because I want people to experience it. But just the things he's talking about and the feeling this silly little shell is holding and the way he holds it. That's what it is about this movie. It's just the way it holds itself, the way it holds the audience. It's incredibly unique right now. So I don't know, you know, the animation is very impressive, but it's simple. Also, there's something about the simplicity of this movie that is very refreshing too. So will it be my favorite animated movie of the year? I don't know. Will it make my top 10 list at the end of the year? I don't know. But right now, it was the movie I needed. I feel like a lot of other people probably need it too. So I'd really encourage folks, if you're on the edge about this, basically, like, I'll wait. Seems like something I should watch at home. Maybe, but right now, July 2022, you might need it right now. So go ahead and go see it.
I love that enthusiasm. I was already starting to get excited about it based on everybody in my life who was praising it. And now you have further encouraged me. Marcel Duchamp with Shoes On, currently playing in limited release. It will go wider July 15th if you see it and agree or disagree if you're a curmudgeon and you disagree with Josh's take on this film.
Who's going to hate on Marcel? Wow. Yeah.
Email us feedback@filmspotting.net. Opening this weekend, Thor, Love and Thunder. We have not caught up with this one yet, but many others have. Metacritic sporting a 62 right now, 71% fresh. That puts it right in the ballpark of my enthusiasm level for new MCU movies post-Endgame.
Okay. Well, we'll see. I just before we start recording, snagged my tickets to see it this weekend. So we're going to go as a family. We're a big Thor household. You know that. So I'm trying not to have my expectations too high, just hoping for a good time and one that gives us enough to talk about next week.
We will talk about it next week. We will also continue our Summer of Stanwyck Marathon with The Lady Eve, and we'll have results from the current film spotting poll, which asks you, what is your favorite Jane Austen film adaptation? Emphasis on film, because we are not including any of those beloved BBC TV Austen adaptations. I think Colin Firth is in all of them.
Yeah, I think that's part. It's a contractual obligation, I believe.
Yes. Now, Sam, who loves to find his own deep flaws in his deeply flawed film spotting poll questions, is now lamenting that maybe we should have gone with a slightly different phrasing, or he's at least wondering if the results would have been different. Clueless, Amy Heckerling's 95 update of Austin's Emma, is currently running away with it as if it's a very good film, but maybe it's not the definitive Austin adaptation. Do you want to punish Sam, Josh? Should we have changed the wording?
So favorite, maybe we shouldn't have gone with, but instead chosen definitive.
Yes.
I'm going to lay awake at night tonight, worried about Sam laying awake at night every time he's posted a poll, just thinking about how he could have worded differently. I mean, yeah. he's got to be a little easier on himself. I think this is just fine.
Yeah, I think it is too. But I agree, it would have yielded different results. I think they're two very different questions. Other options we gave you, in addition to Clueless, 2020's Emma from director Autumn DeWilde, that stars Anya Taylor-Joy. Whit Stillman's Love and Friendship from 2016. Joe Wright's Pride and Prejudice with Keira Knightley from 2005. Or you could go with Ang Lee's Sense and Sensibility from 1995 with Emma Thompson and Kate Winslet. And if we missed something, as long as you're not going with one of those darn BBC TV adaptations, you could go other and write in your favorite. You can vote in that poll and leave a comment at filmspotting.net.
Quick note about what's on our sister podcast, The Next Picture Show, right now. It's part two of their In Baz Taste pairing. They're discussing Baz Luhrmann's Elvis alongside the director's 2001 Best Picture nominated Moulin Rouge. I really enjoyed that first episode. Looking forward to this one. And Adam, that seat on the Baz bandwagon I have saved for you. Shockingly, no one has taken it yet. So
no?
There is still room if you want to join. I'm gonna hold fast to it for you.
Okay.
Next Picture Show hosts are Tasha Robinson, Keith Phipps, Scott Tobias, and Genevieve Kosky. New episodes of The Next Picture Show post every Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts, and you can get more information at nextpictureshow.net. One more quick plug for you. It's for the TC Movie Club. This is something that I started about a year ago over at the day job. Basically, I make a video essay about a movie topic. We get together online to discuss the movie at hand about a month or so later. This summer, we let Movie Club members vote, and they chose for The Prophetic Voice of Jordan Peele. With Nope coming out July 22, thought it would be a great time to look at Get Out and Us and discuss kind of some of the common themes through a theological lens that we see in the movies of Jordan Peele. We're going to get together online 2 p.m. Central, Saturday, August 6. It's a little ways out, but we wanted to make sure everyone had a chance to see Nope on July 22 so that we can incorporate that into the conversation. I do have my video essay, which I made about Us, up available now. That's on the Think Christian YouTube channel. So go ahead and look for Think Christian on YouTube if you want to watch my Us video essay. And if you're not already a member of the TC Movie Club but want to join us on August 6, all you have to do is go to thinkchristian.net/movieclub and sign up. We'll get you all the details. All right. Time for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where we perform a scene and you get a chance to win a Film Spotting t-shirt. A couple weeks ago, we massacred this scene.
Dang, Elvis Presley, you didn't have to rile him up like that.
What now?
No.
Excuse me, what?
I'm just saying, we gotta follow that.
Well, sometimes you have to go all out when you're the king and you can't help it, you know? Because there's only one man who's the king. God picks him, hand plucks him. One night, God looked down at all the millions and millions and millions of people, man. And he decided which one was the best. And it was me. And he plucked me from all those millions and millions and millions of people, man.
Yeah?
Listen to this right now. There's two things you need to know.
Uh-huh.
I'm the king. And number two is, look out, man! Look at that, they're coming at you. You see that? It's called karate, man. And only two kinds of people know it. The Chinese and the king. And one of them is me.
You're the king.
That was John C. Reilly and Jack White in 2007's Walk Hard: The Dewey Cox Story, written by Judd Apatow and Jake Kasdan and directed by Kasdan. That scene was part of a show a couple weeks back when we shared our top five movie summers, which was either 82 or 1999, depending on who you ask. I also shared a few thoughts on Baz Luhrmann's Elvis. So why that scene from Walk Hard?
Here's Peter Dockrell in Lura, New South Wales, Australia, for the first and almost certainly last time. I knew the name of this week's Massacre Theater movie even before action was called. As soon as Adam and Josh began talking about channeling the spirit of Elvis Presley, I was certain we would be getting Josh's take on Jack White's delightfully unhinged portrayal of the King and Walk Hard: The Dewey Cox Story. I know Austin Butler is getting a lot of love for his hip-swiveling performance in Elvis, but I can't help but wonder how differently the movie would have turned out if Baz Luhrmann had cast a mumbling, karate-chopping White in the lead role instead. Thanks for all your wonderful work, Peter says.
I mean, Peter, it could have been Roustabout. There were a lot of Elvis movies to choose from, but you knew we were going to do Walk Hard. Probably smart. We also heard from John Barry in Boise, Idaho. You were upfront about the connection to Luhrmann's Elvis, but there was also a reference to John C. Reilly's stepbrothers in Josh's description of the summer of 2008, which was the same year as Luhrmann's Australia.
I tried to forget that. Brandon Kanaday in Hirosaki, Japan says, the tie-in would be Walk Hard came out in 2007, the best movie year, if not summer, in recent memory. There Will Be Blood, No Country for Old Men, Michael Clayton, and if you'll forgive me, Superbad, top a long list of amazing films from that year. Yeah, Brandon, you forgot Juno. You didn't mention Atonement. There's a few more in there. And 2007 was, in fact, on my top five best movie years. So we have a lot of connections. Our listeners found them all, as always, and some that we didn't think about at all. Josh, reach into the film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
Our winner is Dylan Dom from Blair, Nebraska.
Congratulations, Dylan. Email feedback at filmspotting.net and we will set you up with your very own film spotting t-shirt.
Now you understand the scene. You're not sure if you still love Keith, but you're offering yourself to him in order to save the planet. Look at Jiff, right up here. Now we're starting here.
Uh-huh.
And up, okay. And roll set.
Time now for this week's edition of Massacre Theater. And Josh, I'm just going to be full of hints here, at least for maybe three people in the audience who actually get any mileage out of this. I'm going to be playing the actress who starts the scene off, and that's because I have met this actress, so I think
only I
can appropriately channel her. Now I've set myself up for failure.
I'm only going to believe it if I see a photo where you're like 20 feet away looking in the wrong direction.
Yeah, that's a good inside joke there, Josh. Seven other people will get that one. Here's your other hint. I don't think of either of the women in this scene as women who have particularly dainty voices. In fact, they're a little smoky, so this is going to be tough for me.
What are you going to do?
I don't know. Probably just rehearsing? Sound like me.
No, I don't think that'll do it. I think you're going to want to vary that up a little bit. One more clue, which, again, may not be all that helpful. A movie I vastly underrated when it came out. This is one of those I look back, and I must have been ill. Or Debbie and I had like a huge fight on before I headed out to the screening. I mean, it's really a mark of shame on my review record.
I didn't even realize you didn't like this film. Here's another hint. We haven't talked about it on this show. And you mentioned that in our Slack this morning, and you really could have just kept it to yourself. Now I know that you have this terrible mark on your review record, Josh, because this is movies.
I know.
This movie's great.
Well, and you could tell I was conflicted because I think I gave it 2 out of 4, but everything I wrote was negative. So it was clearly my issue.
Okay. Let's now perform the scene. As I said, I'm going to start it off. So you're going to give me the action.
And action.
That boy from yesterday just dropped this off for you.
Well, put it in the pile of gifts from my other suitors.
He seems like a nice kid. He seemed a little incredibly gay.
Dyed-in-the-wool homosexual that boy is.
I just want you to know your father and I are totally supportive. We love you no matter what the sexual orientation of your opposite sex partner is.
We're not dating, Mom.
And don't worry about not making us grandparents. Although, we were kind of hoping you'd get knocked up so we'd have a second shot at raising kids. Really do it right this time.
Bye now.
And scene.
I know I nailed that last line because I may hear it a couple times a week.
I bet.
So it's kind of embedded.
I bet you do.
In the subconscious. And I also love how your alteration of your own voice was just to slow down.
Yeah, probably.
That gets it. Okay.
If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Tell Josh when you do it how wrong he was about this film. The deadline is Monday, July 18th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced in a couple of weeks.
I want to go where culture is, like
New
York,
did I raise such
or
a
at least
snob.
Connecticut or New Hampshire, well, where writers live in the
get
woods.
Get into those schools anyway.
Mom!
You can't even pass your driver's test.
Because you wouldn't let me practice
enough. The way that you work, or the way that you don't work, you're not even worth state tuition, Christine.
My name is Lady Bird.
Well, actually, it's not, and it's ridiculous.
Call me Lady Bird like you said you would.
You should just go to City College. You know, with your work ethic, just go to City College, and then to jail, and then back to City College, and then maybe you'd learn to pull yourself up.
Laurie Metcalf and Saoirse Ronan in Greta Gerwig's Lady Bird, which came to theaters in December 2017, about 5 years too late to be eligible for our top five movie mother-daughters, a list we did back in March of 2013. At that time, Josh, we paired it with a review of Park Chan-wook's English language debut, Stoker, Nicole Kidman and Mia Wasikowska as the movie mother-daughter pairing there. We're going to revisit that top five here in a moment, but now that we have reacquainted ourselves with our 2013 picks, are there any movie mother-daughters since 2013 or that you've caught up with since 2013, or I don't know, maybe you should have mentioned at the time that now would be in contention?
I mean, I'm pretty happy with my list, but I do think it's interesting that this year alone has given us two clear contenders, I would say, Michelle Yeoh and Stephanie Hsu from Everything Everywhere All at Once, a big favorite for a lot of people this year. Also, a Pixar entry I liked quite a bit, Sandra Oh and Rosalie Chang in Turning Red. And then I just rewatched this past week for the horror book that I'm working on, Robin Nevin and Emily Mortimer in Relic as the adult daughter of a mother struggling with dementia. They're both incredible in that film, and their relationship is really at the heart of it. So that would be one I would consider too, and one I'm going to leave for you because I think as much as I love this
film, you
might like it a little bit more. So yes, well, go ahead, take the floor.
Yeah, it was, in fact, my number one film of last year, Nina Maruss and Josephine Sands in Petit Mama, absolutely would have been a front runner for me if we were doing this list again. I should mention a Pantheon title that I didn't acknowledge back at the start of this list when we did it originally, but we should go ahead and do now. How about Anne Bancroft and Catherine Ross in Mike Nichols' The Graduate? Another one I considered back then when I looked at my list, but I don't think comes up at all. One that checks both boxes. David Lynch's Wild at Heart. You go with Laura Dern's Lulu and Diane Ladd there. Actual movie mother, daughter
there
as
you go.
Well. And one I know you don't appreciate, but I like quite a bit. Chris McNeil, Ellen Burstyn, and Linda Blair. And William Friedkin's The Exorcist is one of my favorite movie mother-daughters.
Yeah, and if we're looking at actually the mother-daughter relationship, I would say that is one of the more interesting elements in that film. So yeah, I could go with that.
So those are just the ones that we didn't include. Think about how good this list must be. And yeah, we didn't even say Lady Bird, obviously. You heard the clip from it. Little Women as well from Greta Gerwig. I just think it's time. I'm not going to do it here. We need to give it its own appropriate ceremony. But I think we're getting to a point where Lady Bird just maybe needs to go in the Film Spotting Pantheon. It can just bypass the penalty box and maybe go right into the Pantheon. Of course, I'd be tempted to put Little Women in there with it. So again, all sorts of good options. We'll see how we did as we revisit this list from 2013, our favorite movie mother-daughters.
I got some good news.
What's that?
I'm unofficially pregnant. I mean, we haven't gotten the test back yet, but you know me, I'm never late.
Well, now I don't understand.
If you're not happy for me, I'm gonna get so mad if you're not happy.
Why should I be happy about being a grandmother?
I don't know how you can talk about famous movie mother-daughter combos without talking about terms of endearment, and Aurora and Emma, Shirley MacLaine and Deborah Winger there from that James L. Brooks film. Unfortunately, I think that's the only love it's going to get in this segment. It's not one I really strongly considered for my list, Josh.
It's easy not to talk about it if you only have vague memories of possibly being brought to the theater to see it with your parents. I think that's where it lies for me, unfortunately.
Yeah, and it's one I've just sort of picked up over the years and never really sat down and given a whole lot of time to. But those performances are very good. And before we get into our list, we want to touch on a few other picks that may not get a lot of love but are worthy of mention. These come to us via Twitter. You can find us, of course, at Film Spotting, but we've been throwing out hashtags for our top five so people anticipating our list can chime in, try to steer us in the right direction.
Do our work for us.
Exactly. We love that. And we do rely on you sometimes to remind us of something we would have otherwise overlooked. And this week's hashtag is simply Movie Mother Daughters, all one word. We got some great entries already, as I said, Josh, including this one from Kyle Brown, who said Jodie Foster and a young Kristen Stewart from Fincher's Panic Room. And we heard from CM Gardner as well with a pick here. I almost don't even want to say it, just in case there's someone out there who has actually never seen this film. But that's kind of ridiculous because it's from the 70s. There's a certain Pantheon movie that we heard from a lot of listeners said, oh, if you're going to talk about mother daughters, you got to mention this film. But no, you really don't. That's not a key
you
part
think this
of the
is
film.
This is a spoiler to say this now?
Yeah, well, I don't think it's a spoiler so much as I just don't think it actually really fits. We're thinking of a certain classic Roman Polanski film where it's more of a gotcha surprise moment than being...
It's not a central relationship.
No, it's not.
For the majority of the film.
That's what I'm saying. So we're just going to leave it at that. But we got some other choices as well that came to us via Twitter.
Yeah, Emily suggested Eve and Joey from Interiors.
A Woody Allen film, his first riff on Bergman, or at least his first blatant riff on Bergman. It's a good pick.
Emily added her own hashtag for that one. Depressing.
So yeah.
Probably applies. Skepacabra suggested Lisa and her mother, who definitely has cancer, in The Room.
I love that one.
Have you seen The Room?
Oh, yeah. We reviewed it here on the show, actually.
You reviewed The Room?
Yeah, we did a listener's choice, I think. It got picked. And I'm really glad I saw it. That's all I'm going
to
say.
Still have to catch up with that one.
So I think we've covered all the bases in terms of the films you have to mention, absolutely, if you're going to talk about movie Mother Daughters. But we still have some great picks here on our own list as we get into the top five. So, Josh, what is your number five?
Yeah, let's get right to it.
Or I should say, who is your number five?
My number five would be, and it's a recent film, a recent relationship, maybe too recent for a top five. I don't know if there's a rule about this, but Princess Merida and Queen Eleanor from last year's Brave. I know that you and I liked it, but for a Pixar movie, you could almost say that this was overlooked. I'm sure it did fine in the box office. I don't really remember, but it didn't receive the usual attention that a Pixar film gets. It does begin as this familiar exercise in anti-princess girl power as Merida, who's this daughter of a Scottish king, she rejects her tradition-appointed suitors, there are three of them, by one-upping them in this archery contest. Of course, this causes a lot of embarrassment for her mother.
Merida, stop this! Don't you dare loose another arrow!
So we've had these sorts of parent-child conflicts in animated stories before, but the movie does take this dramatic narrative twist shortly after that, which I'm not going to give away, but it does force both Merida and her mother to reconsider their perceptions of each other in a truly magical way. I really liked where this movie went. And I'll even admit, their reunion at the end of the film, which is fantastical and an action climax at the same time, got me a little teary. It's really moving when they do have that moment together. I don't know that Brave is one of Pixar's best. It feels just a little different in a lot of ways than other Pixar movies. But the way it does focus on this mother-daughter relationship, I think it stands apart in a crucial way from a lot of Pixar stuff, a lot of Disney stuff, especially that tradition of parent-child dynamics that Disney deals in so often.
Yeah, I like Brave, as you mentioned, and it's one I did consider. Not quite an honorable mention, but it is a movie I considered for this list. I didn't really come up with any fancy criteria for my top five, but I did think about the fact that that relationship had to be central to the story. It couldn't just be, and we talked about this a little bit with that Pantheon movie from Polanski, we were edging around. It can't just be a plot element or the characters are cool or interesting or whatever. It has to be about that relationship. And with that in mind, even though we already spoiled it a little bit at the top of the show, I had to have Margaret and Carrie White from Brian De Palma's Carrie on my list. It's my number five. And as I was making my picks, I was thinking about trying to come up with a word or two that really defines those relationships. And The one that comes to mind when I think about their relationship is really dominance, unfortunately. You've got a mother there, and unfortunately this happens too often with some parent-child relationships where a mother is trying to enforce her will on her daughter and really make sure that she doesn't make the same mistake she did, and she's going about it in a completely misguided, improper way. But it even goes back to a little bit a fairly interesting part in the movie we reviewed this week, Stoker, where Nicole Kidman talks about why people have kids, and she talks about how it's almost as if maybe their goal is to try to start new and to put someone on this earth who they can mold and have them do everything right. They can get it right this time and not fall into some of the same traps. You certainly think that's where Margaret White is going with Carrie. She's going to keep her, most of all, from going to that prom and being seduced by any boys.
His name's Tommy Ross, and he's a very nice boy, Mama.
No.
And he promised to stop him, and
I
maybe
said
you
no.
Go for an Emmy, and I mean, Mama, I'm
no,
accepted,
no,
Mama.
No, no, no,
I accepted, Mama, I accepted.
Come to your closet.
No.
After all you've been taught,
everyone in bad, Mama, everything in the sin.
Come to your closet and pray, ask to be forgiven.
It's a campy film at times, there's no doubt about it, and maybe that's why I love that mother-daughter relationship so much. It's just so much fun, creepy fun, to watch those conversations together. You get the perfect lightning and thunder at the exact moment where she mentions the prom, and those kind of touches from De Palma that are a little bit heavy-handed, but it's fun. It's fun in a really disturbing way, so they're my number five pairing.
Yeah, I do need to revisit Carrie, and it'll probably happen here because of the remake that's coming up, because my memories of it are of all the campy scenes.
Sure.
And so I want to look through it through a little older lens than I don't know how old I was when I saw it, but it's been quite a while. My number four are Ripley and Newt in Aliens. In James Cameron's sequel, Sigourney Weaver's Ripley reluctantly returns to planet LV-426. I have that memorized,
Nicely
Adam.
Nicely done. I'm so impressed.
In addition to Aliens, she finds there this lone little girl, Newt, who's played by Carrie Henn. I really think this is the stroke of genius of the screenplay. It's credited to Cameron, but was also worked on by David Giler and Walter Hill. Because if Alien establish Ripley as this formidable force among manly men. That's one of the things that movie did. Aliens returns her to a sense of femininity by giving her this motherly mission of protecting Newt. Of course, this being James Cameron, who's never been afraid of strong female action heroines, she's still allowed to be this resilient, tough character. So it works within the story's action framework. Of course, I could include on this list, too, because there's that great touch that Ripley runs up against the alien queen who's protecting her eggs.
Right, so you get that crossover there.
Another mother-daughter relationship at play.
Yeah, I thought I was going to be so clever this week that I was going to include Aliens. I was going to cheat because, frankly, they're not really mother and daughter.
This
is a surrogate relationship.
Okay.
And I thought for sure that Mr. Fascist non-cheater here on the show with the top fives would never go for something like this. But there you are, making the case for Aliens. But Josh, I can't argue with you because it's my number four as well. And I think
Good.
You said it very well. I really don't know what else to add other than to say that what I love about that film is, you're right, it does surprise you. It adds a new element to Ripley's character. And by the end of the film, you're so invested in the survival of the characters because of that mother-daughter relationship. More than anything else, I remember feeling when I watched Aliens again fairly recently that I almost didn't completely care if Ripley didn't survive, but she had to keep Newt alive. And of course, I wanted them to be together. And in my perfect happy ending, they would be together. But I remember feeling like after bringing her through all of this, after her surviving that time on that planet alone and them developing this bond, at the very least, she's got to get her out alive, and there's got to be a rainbow here at the end of this grim story. So that is one reason why I love that relationship, but also it's what really makes the third film, which I know a lot of people don't want to talk about, and I totally get that, but that's the most frustrating thing about that movie. I watched them back to back, and after going through this ride with Ripley and Newt and getting so invested in their story and really wanting them to be mother and daughter for the rest of their lives together, you start the third movie, it picks up right where Aliens left off, and they land, and she's dead. There's no time given to it at all. I'm sorry, spoiler alert, at the start of Aliens 3, they've just cut that character out completely, and they just act as if everything you just saw in Aliens doesn't matter at all.
A little harsh.
I think Sigourney Weaver gets a little moment where she laments the fact that she just lost her daughter. But that's all she gets, and the movie goes on from there. And it's so depressing because Aliens was so successful. Now, if you've seen the movie years apart, the way they were made, it may not hit you that much. But you watch them close together, and it really makes you feel regret that they didn't do more with that storyline somehow in the third film. So I'm with you. I love that surrogate relationship. I think it does work for this list.
Are we going to sleep all the way home?
All the way home.
Can I dream?
Yes, honey. I think we both can. Sleep tight.
Affirmative.
All right, well, I participated in that cheat, and here's another one that could be breaking some rules. It's just all coming apart for me in this show here.
I love it.
It's the mothers and daughters, the varying mothers and daughters of Hairspray. In John Waters' 1988 musical comedy, which is about a 1960s teen dance show, there are actually three key mother-daughter relationships
at
play. If I have to pick one, you know, I'm going to pick Tracy Turnblad, played by a luminous Ricky Lake, and her mother Edna, who's played in drag by notorious Waters collaborator Divine.
Not John Travolta.
No.
Is in the remake. You're not going with the remake?
No. You know, I like the remake, but Travolta almost destroys it with his presence.
That.
Let's move back to the original. I think that Tracy's undeterred confidence, you know, famously she doesn't have the conventional Barbie look, but she has this confidence, and a huge part of that surely comes from the confidence that Divine has playing this mother figure. It somehow seeps into the fictional characters as well. Just the fact that he doesn't bother to hide his 5 o'clock shadow, you know, is so great. But there's also in this movie Tracy's best friend Penny, played by Leslie Ann Powers, and her mother, played by Joanne Havrila, and her mother's the one who locks her away after she begins this interracial romance. Then you get even better Amber and Velma von Tussel, who are the reigning Barbie mother and daughter in town. Mother Velma, of course, deliciously played by Debbie Harry.
Now it's time for you know what.
Mother, I know all the dances.
Come on, get up, get up.
Practice makes perfect. I ought to know. Don't forget, I was Miss Soft Crab in 1945, and that title wasn't handed to me on a silver platter. I worked for it. Now, come on, a one, two, three, pony!
So take your pick among the mother-daughter pairs in that group, Adam, but put together, Hairspray is my number three.
Yeah, it's one I completely overlooked, and I'm going to give you a pass, even though you mentioned 12 or so different characters, because that aspect of the film, that mother-daughter relationship, those relationships is so integral to that movie, and I like that movie quite a bit as well. My number three deals with at least one staunch woman, S-T-A-U-N-C-H.
The relatives didn't know that they were dealing with a staunch character. And I tell you, if there's anything worse than a staunch woman, S-T-A-U-N-C-H. There's nothing worse, I'm telling you.
The woman I'm speaking of is Little Edie Bouvier Beale, and her mother, Big Edie, from the Maisels Brothers classic documentary from 1975, Grey Gardens. And as I was thinking about aliens a little bit and the word that sort of defines these relationships, there's a dependency to Ripley and Newt, where we see in Ripley, she gets something out of this relationship with this girl as her surrogate daughter that maybe she even didn't know she needed. Clearly, Newt needs a mom basically just to survive. You go to the Beals in Grey Gardens, and there's a far less functional, much more weird and disturbing
a little bit
type of codependency that goes on between Big Edie and Little Edie. And you do have to wonder what really does keep them together. And that's what I think the Maisels are trying to explore, is not only what keeps them together, but what keeps them in this place, this crumbling facade that they're living in. They're trying to hang on to this old world notion of this aristocracy and the time when they were riding high as this important family. And that staunch scene is so funny because she says, you're dealing with a staunch character. And I know what Little Edie means there, of course, using the word character, but it speaks to another really fascinating aspect of the film, which is how Little Edie seems to be constantly playing some kind of character. Like, they're completely lost in this fantasy world. There is no grasp of reality at all. And another famous scene where she talks about the outfit she's wearing, she even calls it a costume. I think it's the best costume for today. And then it ends with that beautiful tagline that I'm guessing the Maisels behind the camera had to do a little bit of jumping up and down, either in the moment after she said it or in the editing room when they were watching it, and they heard her say, it's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present. You know what I mean? It's awfully difficult. And that's really what this film is dealing with. And we see it play out in that mother-daughter relationship.
That's really interesting that you just referenced the filmmakers possibly jumping up and down when they had something good, because I'm so glad you put this on your list. I wanted to, but I really have a struggle with this movie in the fact that it's verging for me on being exploitative of them. And I know that so many of these personality-driven documentaries, mm-hmm. that's the devil's bargain we make.
Right.
We're going to watch them because they're fascinating, often because they're weird. So it's a bit hypocritical of me to say, well, this one crosses the line. But I have to say, watching this movie, something didn't sit well for that aspect of it. And I think it has to do with that show business you're talking mm-hmm. about, in that both Edies have had attempts at show business in their past, and they seem to be glomming onto the filmmakers as giving them another shot.
Yeah.
And there's no doubt about it. There's that sense of exploiting that desire of theirs, which isn't entirely rational. I mean, I would not dissuade anyone from seeing this movie because
no.
it is so fascinating. What the filmmakers capture is really good stuff, but it's just one that makes me a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, I can see it, but I think that's part of what makes it such a famous documentary. I think you're really getting at one of the interesting layers of that film, because not only are they exploiting the characters, but the characters are exploiting the filmmakers in a way, or
that's
they
true.
Maybe think they are. This is
yeah.
launching
yeah.
them to something, at least Little Edie. And if you've watched other Maisel's documentaries, I mean, they are so good at really getting at this disillusionment, this sense of the American dream gone by you, and the melancholy of that. And I think this film really gets that. I think Salesman is a better documentary from the Maisels, but I would definitely put Grey Gardens up there.
All right. My number two, Mildred and Vida in Mildred Pierce.
Great movie.
It takes guts to go up against Joan Crawford, but that's what Anne Blythe does as her daughter in Mildred Pierce. Crawford's Mildred, she really has no trouble standing up to men. I mean, much of the movie is about her establishing her independence after divorce, but she's almost helpless when it comes to her desire to please this social climbing and thankless, just totally thankless, older daughter. Fairly early on, while Vida is still only a teen, she despises the fact that her mother has had to take a job as a waitress and is already starting to conspire against her.
Vida?
Yes, Mother, what is it?
Where did you find the uniform you gave Lottie?
I was looking for a handkerchief.
In my closet?
I looked everywhere else.
Your handkerchiefs are in your own top drawer where they always are. Now, what were you doing snooping around my closet?
Really, Mother, it seems to me you're making quite a fuss about something which doesn't matter. If you bought the uniform for Lottie, and I certainly can't imagine who else you could have bought it for, then why shouldn't she wear it?
You've been snooping around ever since I got this job, trying to find out what it is. And now you know. You know, don't you?
Know what? Know what, Mother?
You knew when you gave that uniform to Lottie that it was mine, didn't you?
Your uniform?
Yes, I'm waiting tables in a downtown restaurant.
My mother, a waitress.
I took the only job I could get.
Now, it gets much worse from there if you haven't seen the movie. Vida really starts as a snot and eventually turns into, well, I probably don't want to give it away, but it's pretty astonishing how harsh this mother-daughter relationship gets by the end.
Yeah, I guess it's fitting that after starting with Mommy Dearest, we would go to Mildred Pierce and Joan Crawford here for this list. I love that movie, and it's definitely an honorable mention for me. My number two comes from a film that was discussed in detail here on the show back in, I believe it was 2007, when its director, Ingmar Bergman, passed away. The film is Autumn Sonata, and the characters are Charlotte and Eva, though there's another sister, Helena, in the movie as well, who does play a central role. And this is the movie I teased earlier that had a piano connection. You've got Ingrid Bergman as Charlotte, and I want to say this was her last role, or at least her last notable role, and she's so good here in the movie. She is a famous concert pianist. She comes to visit that great Bergman collaborator, Liv Ullmann, as her eldest daughter, Eva. And she hasn't seen her in like 7 years. She's basically completely neglected her two daughters, including one who has some mental and physical problems, and she just put away in a home. And she comes to visit Eva and finds that Eva is there taking care of Helena. And over the course of her stay, a lot of those past skeletons come out, and they really get into the elements of their relationship that have been a problem over all these years. And you start to really understand how Charlotte has been such a self-centered, that's the word I kept coming back to with this relationship, has been so self-centered, and really someone who, unlike, say, Ripley or some of these other mothers that have made our lists who have a natural instinct to be a mom, that's certainly going to apply to my number one, she just didn't have it. She was way too caught up in
her life and her success. And so then when she has to confront the selflessness of her daughter now taking care of the other daughter, the one she completely neglected, that's where the real drama comes from.
3,000 barn varje gång och jag spelade och berättade. Ja, du anar inte vilken succé, men det var förfärligt tröttsamt.
Mamma, det är något jag måste berätta för dig.
Ja?
Helena.
Du skulle faktiskt ha skrivit till mig om det.
It's a Bergman film. It's not light. It's pretty depressing, but a lot of reasons to see it, including not only that relationship, but the performances of Liv Ullmann and Ingrid Bergman.
Well, I'm going to stick with a foreign film for my number one, not quite a classic, though I hope someday it'll be considered this because it is my favorite Pedro Almodovar film. You could pick a lot of his probably, but my favorite is Volver, and the relationship of Raimunda and Irene certainly is key to this story. In some ways, this is sort of a variation on Mildred Pierce in that it's largely a melodrama, it involves murder, and has a main character who starts her own restaurant business that just occurred to me when I was putting this together. That would be Penelope Cruz's Raimunda, who has a daughter of her own, and their relationship is a key part of the story too, but more crucial is her relationship with her own mother, who's played by Carmen Mora, and she returns to the story as a ghost. Now, this is a movie of all sorts of startling revelations, so I'll sort of leave the plot synopsis there. But Volver is really, you know, like so many of his films, it's about the delicate dynamics at play between sisters and mothers and daughters, all those sorts of relationships, mothers and daughters, especially here. In the end, it has this touching hope that if those relationships are strong enough, they may even be able to conquer death. That's sort of what the movie is getting at, which I guess, thinking about it, that makes it a little bit more uplifting than Mildred Pierce. So
yeah,
definitely
just a
differs
little bit
there.
I certainly thought about Pedro Almodovar and all his films with those great female relationships at their core, and Volver is one that almost made my list. It's an honorable mention for me, certainly a great pick. For my list and my number one, I go from the absolute self-centeredness of Ingrid Bergman in Autumn Sonata to the total selflessness of Stella and her daughter Laurel in Stella Dallas. This is a melodrama from 1937, directed by King Vidor, and Barbara Stanwyck, the great Barbara Stanwyck, plays Stella. She's a woman who is determined to rise up in society. She comes from really blue-collar means and isn't very sophisticated. She wants to better herself, and she meets a man who comes from higher society, though he's a little bit down on his luck, and manages to marry him, and they have a daughter, and she still wants to just go out and have a good time. She's not really someone who thinks she's cut out to be a mother. Lo and behold, she's actually really good at it, and it's all she thinks about, and she wants to raise Laurel the right way. And there's a whole lot of plot here I don't want to get into. Suffice it to say, at some point, there comes a moment of recognition on Stella's part that she's never going to be able to change who she is, or society won't allow her to change. She's been put in this box because of her upbringing and where she comes from that she can't escape from. And at the end of the film, she makes a decision that no parent would ever want to make. And I'm going to say 99.999% of us would never be able to make, because we would be thinking about ourselves too much. We would not be able to do this. But she puts her daughter's happiness above her own. And the closing sequence and the closing shot of Stella Dallas is so heartbreaking. I think this movie's made one top five list before, and I don't remember what we called it, but essentially movies that make me tear up a little bit. This is one of them. If you're a mom out there listening and you've never seen Stella Dallas and you watch it, I guarantee it will get very dusty in your living room as you watch this movie. I defy you not to get choked up watching Stella Dallas.
Well, you see, it's this way. From now on, there's lots of things Lolly ought to begin having. Oh, I don't mean money, but dances and parties, you know. Good times. And really, I've never been much at that sort of thing, so I feel that I've done about all I can for her. So I thought that you being so crazy about her father and she taking after him so much that, if you and Stephen got married, why, Lolly could come and live with you. And your name being Mrs. Dallas, you see, everybody would naturally think she was your little girl. And then when you went places, you see,
For March 2013, those were our top five movie mother-daughters. I like that you called out Mildred and Veda from
Mildred Pierce, the Michael Curtiz film noir, when we talked about my number one, Stella Dallas, as well. Very different films in very many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And very opposite types of daughters in those two films.
Yes,
but
that's for
the,
sure.
The sacrificial mother who dares to step outside of her lane, very much a commonality between those two very good films.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm thinking now just two films into this, Stanwyck, you could do a marathon or at least a college course, Adam, this may be in your future, of Stanwyck and Joan Crawford movies parallel, right? Mm-hmm. You could watch Babyface and something like Possessed in the same week, and then you could watch Stella Dallas and Mildred Pierce in the next week. That would be really fruitful, I bet.
If you've got a pick you want to share with us or some feedback on our choices or any other comments about the show, we may just feature those comments on a future episode. You can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. And for more top five lists, check out the Film Spotting archive at filmspotting.net/lists. Josh, that's our show.
If you want to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, or Letterboxd, Adam is at Film Spotting and I'm at Larson on Film. In the show archives at filmspotting.net, you can find reviews, interviews, and top fives going back to 2005. You can also vote in the current Film Spotting poll. What is your favorite? And I think that's a perfectly fine word to use, Sam. What is your favorite Jane Austen film adaptation? To order show t-shirts or other merch, visit filmspotting.net/shop. And you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter at filmspotting.net/newsletter.
Out on digital this weekend, the new one from Claire Denis. It stars Juliette Binoche and Vincent Lindon from Titan fame. It's called Both Sides of the Blade. Also out, The Sea Beast, the new Netflix animated film from the director of Big Hero 6. And This Much I Know to Be True, which was filmed during COVID shutdown. It's a Nick Cave concert film directed by Andrew Dominic. In limited release, one of my favorite movies of the year so far, Fire of Love, the documentary about volcano obsessive Katya and Maurice Croft. Hallelujah, also out. I love a good music documentary. Leonard Cohen, A Journey, A Song, that is a documentary about Leonard Cohen through the prism of his most famous song. Next week on Film Spotting, it's The Summer of Stanwyck Continued, and it's the return of Chris Hemsworth as Thor. We'll talk about the new MCU entry from director Taika Waititi.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Betty Lavendero. Thanks also to Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.